Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
So we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam and Canto 4. We're coming towards the end of that section. So we thank Srila Prabhupada for allowing us to come into his personal quarters so we can speak this Srimad Bhagavatam for his pleasure. And of course we're very, very fortunate to be in this same room where Srila Prabhupada would sit at that desk and, you know, write some of his transcendental literatures. And here we are today. Srila Prabhupada would be very, very pleased to see us studying these books which he dedicated his entire life to translating and publishing and distributing. And explaining. So we were hearing about the good qualities of Prahlad Maharaj. And now we're going to hear how those good qualities in Prahlad Maharaj were there naturally, even from the very beginning of his childhood. So text number 37. From the very beginning of his childhood, Prahlad Maharaj was uninterested in childish playthings. Indeed, he gave them up altogether and remained silent and dull, being fully absorbed in Krishna consciousness. Since his mind was always affected by Krishna consciousness, he could not understand how the world goes on being fully absorbed in the activities of sense gratification. So what's your little boy's name?
Rohan.
What is it?
Rohan.
How old is Rohan?
3.5.
3.5. You're a big boy. Do you know Prahlad Maharaj? Do you know Prahlad and Narasimha? Does he know?
No.
No? Okay. Prahlad was a little boy, he was a devotee, just like you. And Prahlad was always thinking about Krishna. Yeah. And he would sit very quiet and very silently for a long time just thinking about Krishna. Can you do that? Yeah? I think you can, yeah. So Prahlad liked to hear about Krishna and... And you can do that too if you like, and then you'll be Krishna will be very happy. So, but that's not an easy thing for little boys to do. So there's a picture. See? That's Prahlad's father, and there's Prahlad on the lap of his father. Prahlad is just a little boy. But his father would sometimes tease him and try to make him cry. But Krishna protected him in the form of Lord Narasimha. Now, here in this purport, we see that Prabhupada describes that an exalted devotee or Mahatma who is rarely to be seen. Yeah, you have to. Yeah, Prahlad would Prahlad wouldn't talk very much. What's that?
I'm studying, it is four.
Oh, you're four. Oh, okay.
I said 2.5
But four. Thanks for that. That's good. An exalted devotee, Mahatma, who is rarely to be seen, remains fully conscious of Krishna and constantly sees the Lord within the core of his heart. It is sometimes said that when one is influenced by evil stars like Saturn, Rahu or Ketu, he cannot make advancement in any prospective activity. In just the opposite way, Prahlad Maharaj was influenced by Krishna, the supreme planet, and thus he could not think of the material world and live without Krishna consciousness. So this is a sign of a Mahabhagavat. The words here, Krishna Graha. So in the translation there, Krishna Graha means by Krishna, who is like a strong influence, like a Graha or planetary influence. Krishna Graha. So sometimes people are afraid of the astrological portents that are there within their birth chart, especially from Saturn, Rahu, Ketu, some of the evil planets, stars, Prabhupada calls them sometimes. It's interesting Prabhupada calls them stars because we consider the stars more like planets than the sun. So it's interesting he calls the planet stars. But when we worship Krishna, he also has his planet, Vaikuntha. So Shanidev has his planet, Saturn. Rahu and Ketu have their planets. And Chandra has the moon. Chandra is the moon. So different demigods have different planets, and they rule that planet, and they rule a particular influence that affects the universe.
Hurt. Got hurt. I
started
so hot and then I go like that.
Really? Oh, that may have been... maybe Shanidev was giving you a little trouble. Just like the sun, it's interesting because one of the questions, when I used to do astrology, as a Western astrologer, even before I became a devotee, but people would question, how is it possible that the planets influence us here on Earth? Is it, it's ridiculous. It's like superstition. And my proposition was, how could you not think that the planets are influencing you? The sun, when the sun comes out and it's a sunny day, like for instance people who do sales work door to door, they'll tell you that when it's sunny, people will purchase more. If you're going door-to-door selling things, people are in a happier mood. The sun comes out, people are happier. Cloudy day, people are more miserable, they're gloomy. You try and sell them something, they're already in a bad mood, very hard for them to part with their money. See? And people say, just like the moon, the moon influences the tides of the ocean. Massive, big tidal waves, big tidal surges. Our bodies are made up of, 80% or more of water. To say that the moon has no influence on us, imagine the effect it has on the movement of liquid within our body, cyclically. So that would affect us cyclically. So each planet has an influence And, you know, there are particular gems that you can purchase. So for, you know, the Venus, you may wear the diamond. For Mercury, you may wear the jade or the emerald, the green colours. For Saturn, you may wear the blue sapphire or lapis lazuli. For Mars, you might wear the you know, red coral or bloodstone. So just as you can take a magnifying glass and you can take the rays of the sun, and if you have the proper magnifying glass, it captures those rays of the sun. You know, the rays of the sun are all around us. They're not causing us any trouble. But when you get the magnifying glass, it captures those same rays and you can start a fire within 10, 20 seconds because it concentrates those energies. So each of the gems, they concentrate those energies into your person or your home like that. So they have the particular stones will capture particular influences. And so, and each planet has a presiding deity. Actually, you know, just like Bhumi is a presiding deity of Earth, but actually, you know, in the time of Maharaj Yudhisthira, he was literally the ruler of Earth. He was protecting Bhumi, even. So, but there is another graha, which is a spiritual graha, that is Krishna Loka. That is a planet that people don't consider, Krishna Graha. But the influence of Krishna Graha is, as we see, in one who's been influenced by Krishna Graha, that they find it very difficult, they could not think of the material world and live without Krishna consciousness. So they can't stop thinking of Krishna. So people who become influenced by the evil planets or stars, as Prabhupada says, they can't think of Krishna. They can't think of spiritual life. In fact, they can't make advancement in any prospective activity. You know, so... And the devotee, in one sense, can't make advancement materially because they have no interest in that. Just like Raghunath Das Goswami. He had so much wealth, fame, strength, beauty, the most beautiful wife, but he could not make any advancement as a householder. So he wouldn't even go inside. He used to sleep on the outside the house. He couldn't make any progress as a householder. He couldn't stop thinking of Krishna. So he's influenced by the Krishna Graha. At that. So this is the sign of a Mahabhagavat. What was his name again? Is that Rohan? Oh, Rohan, yeah. Now, do you know Prahlad Maharaj used to sit very quietly for a long time? And he didn't speak and he didn't play. Do you think you could do that? That's very hard to do. Very hard to do. But, you know, you may have to. He can play outside if it's difficult. Yeah, that might be easy, yeah. Thanks for coming, Rohan. All right, we'll see you again. Good. Tell me when you're 5. Come and see me. All right.
How old are you now? How old are you?
3. You can come and see me before that. Yeah.
This on the difference of the planets and, you know, when usually people, when they wear the stones and how does it exactly, because we say that past karma, right? It's just the different planets are just kind of they're just kind of enacting, they're being like an instrument to give us a reaction to past karma. How does the different stones and different, how does that really, does it change up? Does it mean that we are changing our karmas?
Well, we follow what Prabhupada said. Prabhupada said, make the best use of a bad bargain. Right? So, the bad bargain, okay, you've got something, perhaps you would have liked something better, but you didn't get it. So, there's nothing you can do about that. You can't get the better thing. You got a bad bargain. So, make the best use of that. That's your free will. So, what we're given in this world according to our destiny, that's our bad bargain. Making the best use of it is, let's, everything that we can maximize our getting the best use out of what we've got is what we should be doing. That's intelligent. Therefore, we are all born with certain built-in faults within the body where we're susceptible to certain illnesses. More so than other people. And but we don't just say, well, that's my karma, okay? I catch a cold really quick, I get the flu really quick, that's, other people don't. So what we do is we try and fine-tune the body, take different medicines which strengthen the immune system. We try to, we understand that there's a defect there, and we make all the arrangements whereby, knowing that we're more likely than another person to catch a cold or a flu, we make precautions so that we will get at the minimum. See, that's making the best use of a bad bargain. So some of the ways we trying to get the best use out of this body, we get an education. Right? I mean, if we say, let's not use gems to enhance our ability to get the best use out of the body and mind, then let's also not get an education. Let's also not go to the doctors. Let's also not keep fit. Let's also not wear warm clothes. Let's also not wear protective clothes. You see? That doesn't make sense. Now, it's one of the things, since I became a devotee, when I became a devotee in 1978, I was already an astrologer. I'm only just starting to be accepted within it, certain parts of ISKCON, depends which part of the world you're in, after, going on nearly 40 years, because of foolish philosophies where somehow people think that if you take some measure to look after your body and mind, you're not surrendered to Krishna. So, if someone, if you perhaps wear a gem that beneficially captures influences which are there in the universe, the energies, and wards off inauspicious influences, there's no difference to that than knowing that there are germs in the atmosphere. You can't see them, but you know they're there. And you're protecting yourself from those very subtle unseen influences in the best way you can. There's no difference at all. And yet, if someone follows the more subtle science of astrology, they consider they're doing it because they're not surrendered to Krishna. And if someone looks after their body by, you know, taking vitamin C and what have you, they're considered, yes, they're surrendered. But there's no difference. You see? If we follow this, that sort of philosophy, don't ever check the tires on your car. Don't ever check the oil. Don't check the water. Don't even look at the gauges. Don't lock it. You know, because Krishna will protect you.
Don't check the weather report.
Forget the weather report.
You can go out and Krishna will...
Don't get an education. Why educate the kids? Krishna will protect them. You see? So, and yet, as foolish as that is, to this day, astrology is almost like treated like a disease in ISKCON in certain places. That is a symptom of the person's lack of surrender. And yet, in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, one astrologer went to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and said, I'd like to do astrological reading. Oh, okay. So he accepted. And he says, oh, I don't understand what I'm seeing. I see that you are the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Lord Chaitanya accepted his astrological reading, and because he offered his profession in the service of the Lord as anyone else does, even prostitutes, a prostitute can, you know, try to offer some service, offer some, you know, nice sense or something to the Lord, but an astrologer can't. Because he rendered service to the Lord and the Lord accepted it, he was blessed by Lord Chaitanya to become a pure devotee and went back to Godhead. It's in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. So, you know,
maybe you should write a book on how to get astrology accepted in ISKCON.
No, they'll throw me out of ISKCON.
Prabhu saved my life. Because I understood that as a Krishna's arrangement. You know, like a few years ago, I was going to India, and he mentioned that Mars cancels the good influence of Jupiter.
Mm.
And because he was telling me, that was Krishna telling me. And then a few other things happened, which I got a warning. And like I listened to that warning, and I was prepared. And thanks to him, I'm still alive here.
Forearmed is forewarned.
Yeah.
It is just like a weather report, that's what I say. Someone tells you there's a hurricane. You know, one time my oldest daughter, she had booked tickets to go to, you know, I think it was somewhere in Vietnam, you know, one of those places, very... Well... She came up to me and she said her and her partner had booked the tickets and they were going for a holiday because they were both getting time off work. And she said, I should have asked you before, but can you do an astrology reading for that? And I looked at her and I said, well, you know, I'm sorry to say it, but you shouldn't go. And she said, I've already booked the tickets. And I said, well, don't go, you know. So, you know... She cancelled the tickets, which is a big thing, and they went to Queensland instead. And at the exact time, the place where they were going to go was where they had those floods. What was it?
Tsunami.
Yeah, tsunami.
2004.
Yeah. There were hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people affected. Thousands of people lost their lives. And they would have been foreigners in a flood-affected country. Even if they lived, you know, then you've got the disease and just trying to get out of there. So that was the exact place at the exact time they were going. So they didn't go. Prabhupada himself gave this example that, you know, to verify that Prabhupada was against astrology in that he understood that many devotees may make the mistake of where you can take shelter of Krishna and Krishna's guidance, you take shelter somewhere else. He didn't want that. No, you know, devotees should not do that. That if something can be understood properly by good instruction from, you know, Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita, you know, Krishna's guidance, you don't need to go to astrologer or anything like that. But he gave this, that sometimes there are some things you actually can't be seen and you can take advice astrologically. So he gave this example that, you know, in his family, their doctor, their family doctor, is, you know, very well known, very well respected. Might have been Bose or something like that. There was a lot of Boses in India. Is there a common name, Bose?
Bose? It's a Bengali surname.
Yeah, like every Bengali.
Almost,
yeah. Because it just comes up again and again. But so this this doctor, I think it was Bose, so he was treating a patient who had this problem with the throat, and the person was so ill he was dying. And the doctor kept trying to treat him, but the person got worse and worse, and he was feared he would die. So he said, you know, I want you to go to this astrologer. And he went to the astrologer, and the astrologer, you know, looked at the chart and he said, you don't have this disease, you have this disease. So he's not a doctor, he just understood the astrological science. And the person went back to the doctor and said, the astrologer said, this is actually my... And he treated him for that and then he got better. The Prabhupada tells that story about some things can't be seen even by, you know, persons of great knowledge and professional status. So, you know, sometimes, you know, the use of astrology has some benefit like that. Especially, you know, sometimes for marriage. You know, when you know, you got to wait 7 years in most places in the world, and there's so many strange people around, you know, no one's got good qualities in the age of Kali. You know, if someone wants to get married, then you've really got to sort of think, well, I'll try and get to know this person. You know, you might have to go through 50, 100 people to try and get to know them over so many years, or you can just look astrologically within 2 minutes, you know, or, you know, 5 minutes or what have you, you can see, oh, this person's not right for you, this person not right. Yes, this person will be, you'll live. So some things you just can't tell any other way. You know, therefore, it has some applications, but Prabhupada understood that in most cases, one, astrologers tend to brush aside Krishna, and devotees should also not do that. They should first understand everything that is available through Krishna consciousness, through the Guru. That, you know, that's the first place they look. And sometimes, you know, if that's helpful, you know, just like you can't treat every disease that happens. Generally, if you read the Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita, you know, most devotees will have a good sense of what keeps them healthy, you know, on a daily regular basis, you know. They're moderate in their eating, sleeping, you know, work, recreation, you know, they practice celibacy, they eat, you know, certain types of sattvic foods. So many things, they drink, you know, water, and they have fresh air, and they sleep well and things. And they'll keep avoiding stress, they'll keep healthy. They're the main things for good health. But then sometimes someone may get something and, you know, you don't know. You'll have to go to a doctor and find out that, you know, my usual program of good health, I don't know, I've got something that is, you know, really destroying my life. Now, if a devotee goes to a doctor It's not as if they're going outside of Krishna consciousness. It's not as if they've sort of, you know, left the shelter of the guru or left Krishna's shelter. You know, sometimes, you know, they actually have to go somewhere and get that special professional help. And astrology is exactly like that. So, but Prabhupada didn't want that where it is possible. So in other words, what, for example, if we replace astrology with a doctor, Prabhupada didn't want the devotees running back and forth to the doctors every second day like a lot of the non-devotees do. You know, he wanted, you follow the principles of the Bhagavatam, you'll basically keep healthy. That's where your general good health will come from. Don't dismiss the Bhagavatam and depend solely on the doctor to keep and live an unregulated life and not practice celibacy and, you know, eat, you know, the wrong things like that. So don't dismiss the philosophy of Bhagavatam and then depend on the doctor, which is what everyone in this world does. See? So astrology is in the same category like that. But it's not very well understood in ISKCON. You know, in the early days, if you were sick, no one got your medicine. Nor did anyone really look after you. It was almost like, although it still happens these days too, it depends, you know, who you are, but it was almost like, you know, to look after another devotee's body was maya, or to look after your own body was maya. You just had to tolerate. I remember my first trip to India. I was so ill, you know, because I lived a very, in some respect, unhealthy life, you know, before I was a devotee. And a lot of smoking, drinking, this and the other. But, so when I went to India, you know, I got a lot of, I just didn't have an immune system and I got really ill. And in those days, of course, the travelling conditions were very austere. There was a lot of dysentery and dilly belly and, you know, this, that and the other. So we did this bus trip from, I don't know where it was, from Mayapur to Jagannath Puri or something like that. How far is that? How far would it be, a bus trip from Mayapur to Jagannath?
Train all night.
Bus trip.
Train is usually all night, so maybe more, 7-8 hours?
No. More. Oh yeah, it's a
at
big...
At least bus will take at least 40-50 hours.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So this was supposed to take about that time, but, you know, we added another 6 or 7 hours or something like that on it. So I was sick when I got on that bus. I became so ill... I was a brahmachari. I was on the floor. This is metal floor, you know. An Indian road. Potholes, rocks, you know, everything. I was literally, I was so ill, I was delirious. So delirious that I was literally laying there in my kopans. I mean, there was women and men, you know, brahmacharis. I was laying on the floor in my kopans for that, it was something like an 18, 20-hour trip. And that is so ill. And I just, that was it. I just had the copper sweet. And there was, when we got to Jagannath Puri, they had to carry me up into the, you know, the Dharamshala where we stayed. And then what happened was all the devotees went out on pilgrimage and they just left me laying there. So then there was this devotee, I'll never forget, Jamunacharya. Brings a tear every time I think of him. He was from another temple. He used to be in Melbourne, and then he went to Mwulumbah. And he came in, he said, you look like you're going to die. I said, I think I am. He said, who's looking after you? I said, no one. He said, who's getting your medicine? I said, no one. So he didn't go out in the parakram. He went out and he found a doctor and he found some Ayurvedic medicine, and you know they came back and they fixed me up. But I never never forget it. And I spoke to Balaram, who was temple president, because I joined ISKCON. It was 1980, so I mean I joined in late 78, so I've been a devotee for about a year, and I said to Balaram, I can't understand the difference between our philosophy and the way what just happened. I said, I expected a lot more from devotees. It's almost like there's a gap between the devotee behavior and what I'm reading in the books. Yeah, and he said, yes, I'm sorry about that, but that's
reality.
The reality. And I knew then that, I had to sort of really look after myself, as a devotee. Don't expect that, people are going to come running looking after you. Right then I knew you got to just tough it out and, don't put yourself in a situation where you might need another devotee's help, because it may not come. So that was my introduction. Krishna gave me an introduction. And I was so ill, there's some funny things happen. I've got a picture. I went to one place. I thought at least I have to go once here, and literally after the Ayurvedic medicine, I went to the top of one building, and there's a picture of me, Aniruddha, Pushpanjali, Krishna, Vesustrasa, like that. So that was that. I was just struggling to stand. And then we went back to Vrindavan. So we're in Vrindavan. A Korma comes up to me and says, oh, you look terrible. I said, yeah. He says, I think you've got jaundice. You're looking very yellowish. I go, am I? So he decides to treat me. So he says, in the Bhagavatam, he says, straight out of the Bhagavatam, he says,
Rokhan.
So he brings me in this big thing of rock candy, right? So I'm laying on the floor somewhere. Right, so I can't go anywhere because I'm just literally, laying there. That's all I can do is just lay there. I'm too weak to eat this rock candy. Like, I tried to bite it and, within 20 seconds I was like, that's too much, and I'm thinking, Korma says I've got to eat this and it'll make me better. So I had a load of water and I dropped about half of it in the load of water. And then I dozed off for a bit, and then I woke up, and I said, oh, I've got to drink the medicine. And I drank this rock candy, and I was hallucinating for hours. I was thinking, here I am in the Dharm. It's like I'm on drugs or something. It's Krishna fulfilling all my desires, So, the other thing that happened, when I was actually in Jagannath Puri, before Jamuna Charity came in, right, so I was literally not far off death, some German devotees come in. And they said, you look terrible. I said, yeah. They go, we got just a thing for you. And they brought in charcoal tablets. Have you ever seen that? Charcoal, yeah, the big thing.
So,
what? They're just charcoal. But they're like little round things like a... So he said, eat them, you'll be right,
Charcoal.
Charcoal, it's just straight charcoal, yeah. It's supposed to...
That's not an anti-flagellant.
Yeah.
From gas.
Okay, now what they didn't take into consideration, already I hadn't eaten food for about 2 weeks, and I was barely drinking water. So the first thing that hit my system was charcoal. And I just, again, I went into this hallucination. I was just hallucinating, and I kept thinking people were coming in and out and doing all these strange things. I was just literally tripping on this. It just about killed me. that is very extreme. But you know, it shows you the extent of that. Mentality that looking after one's body or even another devotee's physical body is somehow maya. And it's that same, influence which goes into things like, going to visit a doctor or astrology or, getting marriage counselling, people are having difficulty with marriage or so many different things that, or sometimes devotees suffer from depression or, anxiety or so many different things. It should actually be looked after, fully to make the best use of, the situation like that.
How did that mentality came into his car? Because Rupa treated all the devotees. If they were sick, he gave them medicine, he gave them
yeah.
advice to get better.
Well, I'll tell you how, because, for instance, say you're in a place like Australia, people are joining the movement, they're literally straight off the streets, they'd never seen Prabhupada, they've never read the books, they come into the temple, they say, look, here's a roll of paintings, or here's a bunch of incense, go out and sell these, there's your bhishadam. They do a little reading, they do a little singing, they chant their rounds, but they've really got no idea about Krishna consciousness for years and years and years. So whatever is sort of going on in their head, out in the street, they're literally, it takes a long time. The good thing about, in one sense, that generally when people come in, they did tend to just follow devotees because you knew, I don't know nothing about Krishna consciousness. I don't know anything, so I'll just keep my mouth quiet and just follow. But the problem is that if there was a misconception, it pervaded everyone. No one could detect it was a problem. So if there was something which was, against, the actual philosophy, it was foolish, it was impersonalism or what have you, It just became, mainstream behaviour. That was the danger in it. And, therefore, there were, within ISKCON there have been many big upheavals where all of a sudden these different, misconceptions about the guru, misconceptions about the disciple, misconceptions about so many different things have just literally, on a huge scale caused a massive upheaval. And that's why we have these classes, to sort of make sure that everyone, has the correct understanding of, and having the correct understanding sometimes. You need to see how far things can go wrong when we're not following Prabhupada's philosophy. So, the history of ISKCON, we shouldn't look at the history of ISKCON as, dark pages that somehow should be neglected. The history of ISKCON, just like we look at the history of the Gaudiya Math, we look at it through the eyes of Prabhupada. Prabhupada, it taught us something that we follow very strictly in ISKCON. Don't let one person be the absolute authority on all things. There must be many leaders joined together in a systematic way, organizing things. Not just one person, running everything. That was Bhaktisiddhanta warned against that. They didn't follow, everything collapsed. So Prabhupada, you know, we will study that history of the Gaudiya Math, but, you know, thousands of years, so that we don't do that. But we also study our own movement, ISKCON, where Prabhupada said, don't do this. You know, if the movement expands very quickly and you surround yourself by many neophytes, it will implode upon itself. That means it's not going to be thwarted from outside. It will literally be thwarted from within. So, you know, if the movement expands, the onus is that if we don't train people properly according to Shastra, it will create a problem. It's not that, oh, they'll all bring money and so many things and everything will be wonderful. No, it will create a big problem. There'll be so many untrained people with different strange concepts about Krishna consciousness, and it will cause a massive problem. So, you know, we learn from the mistakes of ISKCON. It's very important.
But probably sometimes even the group of devotees who regularly read Srila Prabhupada's books, but then they seem to have some fundamental misconception.
That's right.
So it would seem that more important than even reading, it would be hearing from people, from authorized sources.
Yeah.
Without that hearing, plus reading, there still seem to be misunderstandings.
Guru Sadhu Shastra. That, you know, we take shelter of the Guru, Srila Prabhupada, and, you know, very senior devotees in our movement, teaching the you know, Shastras, the Vaishnava Shastras. We need the Guru because some of the things we're reading the Shastra, but we can't understand. The Guru explains it very nicely because they have the realization. But then that must be accepted by the sadhus, the god brothers of the Guru and the peers and senior god brothers of the Guru there has to be a consensus. Yes, that's that's acceptable also to the other devotees, senior devotees within this movement. So not that one is a Guru and they're preaching something and other very senior devotees are saying, well, you know, we're not happy with that. That, you know, so the Guru, the Shastra, and Sadhu, you know, like that. So the Shastra is central. The Guru, we have had. See, what happened with the zonal acharyas was we didn't have Sadhu. We had Shastra, and each zone had one absolute Guru. And I saw even, you know, very advanced God brothers, they literally had very little influence. Whatever the Guru, you know, said, everyone had to follow, and everything else was squash. So the sadhus had very little, you know, opportunity to sort of say, well, that seems a bit fanatical or a bit over the top like that. So that zonal acharya system, the problem there was the lack of sadhus, peers, having an equal say to what, you know, to what the Guru is saying. As to, well, this is a bit of a radical presentation, you know, of the Bhagavad Gita, or, you know, this is, you know, the devotees, the way they are engaged may not be, you know, as all-rounded as what it should be. You know, in I remember one of the original 12 gurus, Hamsa Dutta Maharaj, he came to Mayapur one year. I was there, sitting there, and he was saying, you know, if we don't just sell Prabhupada's books, I'm not coming next year. I was thinking, that's radical, you know, like, you know what I mean? It's like, sort of, almost like, sort of, you know, there are all sorts of different services. It's not as if every single devotee has to be selling books. You know, we know that books are the basis, but, you know, we can't be condemning, you know, devotees who are not selling books as if, you know, okay, that's just outrageous. Sort of. Anyway, I don't know that he actually came next year. I think after that what happened, because, you know, in some parts of the world, I think in that part of the world, they started running guns and drugs and all sorts of things to facilitate the book distribution. There's some weird thing, you know, going on. But, you know, then you had... In England, Jaitirtha Maharaj, who was, you know, started taking LSD to sort of, you know, spice up the ecstasy and the kirtan and, you know, things like that. So, but, you know, you had this guru figure. So you imagine that. You imagine in today's society, one of the gurus having kirtan and intoxication is being distributed. It just couldn't happen, right? Unless that guru was an absolute authority and his peers had no say, it just couldn't happen. You see? So there's guru, sadhu, sastra. So that's the answer to your question. There must be, you know, therefore, you know, management, in Vedic management means that, you know, there is perhaps a central leader. But that leader has appointed, you know, advisors who are expert in different departments, and the leader takes the advice from the and you know, has great respect for those advisors. If there's a leadership where if someone has a different opinion, they're not asked for their advice. Then again, you know, this is, you know, not utilizing the sadhu principle and that. So guru, sadhu, sastra, when, you know, when that is there, all three of them, then that's the checks and balances from scripture. And where we haven't done that in ISKCON, if we haven't had enough shastric input, this problem. You know, not enough input from the sadhus, problem. And there also has to be, you know, a good example, leaders, gurus, you know, good leaders, you know, very strong leaders, you know, central figures, that's good. But, you know, who take advice from other sadhus like that. So that is the answer to the question.
And it also seems that those temples, when more senior Vaishnavas come, as compared to just one or two senior Vaishnavas, are more filthy. Like the senior Vaishnava, even if they're one or two that come, are very senior, the understanding and explanation and everything is correct. But still it seems that those temples where more senior Vaishnavas come are healthier.
Not necessarily. Unless that temple promotes amongst the community that it's healthy for the community to take shelter, advice, freely from other senior devotees, even though it may not necessarily be, you know, the same policy that the management has. So what happens is that you can have senior devotees, but if they're seen by management as somewhat as a competition, then it's very easy for them to be neglected or not really given an opportunity to have any influence. So just give an example. You know, when I go to Mwulumbah, one of the things that strikes me is, you know, they have a lot of senior devotees there. When I mean senior, not just Prabhupada disciple, but also, you know, second generation, seasoned Sankirtan devotees, and you see them, and yet I see that they have a very, you know, a big younger generation in Mwulumbah. A lot of young people at that. And most of the, when I was interacting with the younger devotees, a lot of them had no idea of the senior devotees that were just maybe one or two, not many, you know, there might be, you know, oh, there's Harishwar Maharaj or Mukunda. Apart from that, they really didn't know, you know, oh, this devotee, you know, has spent nearly 40 years doing Sankirtan, preaching, you know, good quality devotee, very quiet, humble, you know, like that. But you wouldn't even, they wouldn't even know. Literally, they didn't even know he'd done anything for, you know, he just looked like an old man. He wandered in. And so it's not necessarily because the older devotee is there, unless, you know, the actual, it's part of the process for the temple authorities to promote in the community, please take advantage of these senior devotees. If that's not there, you know, then they can literally disappear. So
so we should have a list of senior devotees posted on the notice board with their phone numbers so the devotees can contact them.
Well, you don't have to have a list, but you know there are general etiquettes that are followed. They know, because if they're watching some of the senior local devotees, and what happens is a senior devotee comes in, and the local senior devotee makes sure that everyone's going to see, I'm going to pay special attention to this people because I want to advertise this devotee in this community. And if they don't do that, then, you know, but that's a normal etiquette. That's a normal etiquette. Especially, we read in the Srimad Bhagavatam that actually, just like the sages of Naimisharanya, when someone stood up to glorify Sudha Goswami, because they understood, here comes a very nice devotee. Who is it that stands up and makes it known to everyone the caliber? It's usually the most wise and experienced member of that group. It's their duty to do that. Like that. What's that? Yes. So it's just a normal etiquette. But if the etiquette disappears in a community because it's not practiced by the senior devotees, then senior nice devotees can come and go, and a few may be pointed out and others not, according to one's advantage.
Not even present on a day-to-day basis in the temple area, so to be practical, we have to have some kind of list posted.
Well, not necessarily this, but you know, usually the general etiquettes, you know, are quite effective.
Because general etiquettes is a very soft process.
No, general etiquettes are very pronounced. They're soft because we don't know what a general etiquette is. Therefore, we think, oh, you know, it's almost invisible. That's because no one's doing it. It's like, you know, if people don't say please and thank you. And you say, oh, I don't know whether someone appreciates it. It's such a invisible. That's because no one's saying please and thank you. What's, you know, you say please and thank you. Yes, I appreciate. You know, the etiquettes are very powerful. And they stand out, especially when they're followed by, you know, senior devotees.
The thing is also that if a senior devotee comes, the very fact that their presence will anyway be noticeable well, because their ways and mannerisms, someone who's really senior and advanced Krishna consciousness, will reflect in their personality. You can't fake
something. No, but...
the senior devotees are also humble, so they don't want to step up and take a board or...
Actually, someone asked a question to Gaura Kishore Das Babaji that he said that the surest and most potent way to get Krishna's blessings and to make spiritual advancement is to take shelter of advanced devotees. And then he asked Gaura Kishore Das Babaji, he said, but... the nature of the devotee is that they act in ways in which, you know, they don't, their qualities and abilities and what have you are not promoted or they're unseen. And actually it's very hard for someone to recognize actually who is, you know, an advanced or mature devotee. So especially, you know, the less one has advancement, the less ability one has to recognize advanced devotees. So he said, why is it? Why is it that Krishna allows a process whereby the most effective means to make advancement, to take shelter of advanced devotees, and yet Krishna somehow hides the advanced devotees? And Gaura Kishore Das Babaji answered that. He said that if an insincere person does even a little service for an advanced devotee, I give myself to them. He didn't. Krishna doesn't want to be indebted to insincere people. So he likes to hide the glories of his devotee, and he tests the devotee to see that if they're very sincere, then he will reveal to that person that this here's a nice devotee, you take advantage of him, you can make advantage of him very quickly.
Like Sukadeva Goswami came, but it's not automatically. He himself came.
So that's why in the Chaitanya Charitamrita it says, by the mercy of Krishna, Krishna gives the blessings to the Guru or the Vaishnava, and by the mercy of the Vaishnava you get Krishna. So first of all, when Krishna sees that one is sincere, then he allows one to, somehow they realize, oh, this is a, you know, Krishna's allowed me to see something here. This is actually, I just think in ordinary, this is something special in this devotee like that. Krishna allows a person to see that. And when that person sees that, that person makes, you know, they take that association. And then when they offer some service, you know, or they hear from that person, Krishna becomes indebted, because if that devotee thinks fondly, oh, this person has, you know, given some nice service like that, then Krishna becomes indebted to that person because his devotee has thought nicely of him, and he, Krishna, just gives himself to him. So that's why he actually, you know, covers over. So it's not a fact. It's not necessarily, you know, devotees. In fact, you know, we see in the Chaitanya Charitamrita so many examples of, you know, very exalted devotees who were not only not recognized, but quite often they're mistaken to be the biggest rascals. Look at Prabhupada. You know, look at Prabhupada's life. He's all his god brothers thinking, you know, who is this person? Srila Bhakti Siddhanta says what he understood, because he's very sincere. But you know, it was only after Prabhupada did what he did that a few of them started to, you know, see, well, there's something, you know, extraordinary here in this world. Otherwise, they just Prabhupada joked, well, Prabhupada said that, you know, they used to refer, you know, like a rotten grihastha, like rotting in grihastha life, you know. Just, they're not advanced devotees, just, you know, just rotting in grihastha life, you know, like that. They spoke of him in very derogatory terms sometimes. He's a Nitya Siddha. He's one of Krishna's dearest devotees. And even, you know, even those trained devotees, what to speak of others, couldn't recognize him. So, you know, it's... but senior devotees, you know, the more qualified one is in devotional service, the more one should be able to recognize. And certainly, therefore, it's the duty of leading devotees to actually help other devotees recognize that, oh, here's a nice devotee like this, people should listen like that. You know, take some association and like that. They should not feel threatened by that.
So the safe policy is to treat everybody as if they are elevated devotees in service?
Yes, that's right. That's exactly right. You know, when I went to Mawulamba, I'll come back to him. Not that I'm a senior devotee or anything, but you know, I went to get some khichdi, some breakfast, and you know, I got a scoop. I was really hungry. When I travel, I get a big appetite. Anyway, they gave me a scoop, and it wasn't even, you know, it was like a quarter of what I'd normally eat when I'm not hungry. And I said, oh, can I have some more? And I said, no, you know. And, you know, like I looked at the line, so I've you know, served hundreds of thousands. I could see with just a glance that there'd be khichdi left, even after they served everyone to their full satisfaction. Anyway, I wasn't going to argue with him, so, you know, I just did my usual thing and I snuck around to another table and got some there. But, you know, that what he should do, you know, for the sake of, is just treat everyone. You don't know who someone is, but you're just very careful with everyone. That's a good policy. And then I sat next to a girl who was, I think, Korean. There's only two Korean devotees in Australia, so she's a friend of Sava Amrita. And I don't think she was initiated then, but I sat next to her. And I was having a chat with her, and I was saying, oh, there's so many nice devotees here. And she was saying, oh, really? And I said, see that one over there, and I was telling about this one. I said, see that one over there, I was telling about, and I said, see that one over there, I was telling about. She goes, oh, I wouldn't have even known, you know, I could have made so many mistakes. And she said, you know, what should I do? And I said, oh, you know, basically, you know, take the opportunity when you sit down with someone, talk to them. You know, don't assume who they are by what they look like. Ask them, you know, what have you done, and, you know, what are you doing, and, you know, like that. And you'll probably be pleasantly surprised how many, you know, nice devotees. But, you know, have an open mind like that. Be careful and, you know, communicate with them. Don't just sort of neglect people. But, yeah, she took that on. Yeah.
Last night, Guru Maharaj, he was saying a story, one of the first stories I was hearing. And he was saying how in Italy they had one monastery and they had left only three monks there, I think a Catholic one. And I don't know whom they asked what we should do, because it's dwindling, you know, like they ask someone that who is kind of like a, I don't know, some sage. And she said, one of three of you is actually a very dear follower of Jesus, very special personality. And he didn't tell which was, they asked him who it was, and it was told to these three, and everyone was thinking, because it's not me, it must be either this one or that one, and they started thinking like that, and everyone started treating the other one really, really well.
There may be
and
this.
And when
yeah.
the surrounding people saw how they treat each other, they start sending their sons, and the others got attracted to join them. But they had that respect.
And that's right. There was that story also at Ramanuja pastimes, right, where the brahmacharis were complaining about the grihasthas. There were some grihasthas, and you know, so they got. I think they got some of the brahmacharis something to go and steal their cloth, their jewelry. And was it the wife? She was lying there, and you know, she rolled over so they could get the jewelry from the other side. But anyway. They realised that these were actually, you know, really nice devotees, you know, that they had a material vision, but they were treating them in a very material way. But then by Ramanuja's tricks, they realised that actually these were very advanced and we were not so very advanced. You know, our behaviour was very appalling and their behaviour was exemplary like that. So it's very common. It's actually, you know, if you go through, you know, the lives of the acharyas, what to speak of others, a lot of the acharyas were taken as just ordinary, you know, people, or in fact anything but a saint, you know, in some cases. And that is because of what Gaura Kishore Das Babaji said, that actually Krishna has a policy that he literally hides the glories of his devotees, you know, so that, you know, people, you know, you don't have all these rascals who are really insincere, you know, that Krishna's indebted to them. Because he will give himself to someone that, you know, his pure devotees are affectionate to, or, you know, give blessings to. So, so Prahlad Maharaj, and look at Prahlad Maharaj. He's a Mahabhagava. He's a 5-year-old child. So we had a little boy in class when we first got here. Right, so little, was it Rohan? He was three. His mother said he was 3 and a half. He said no, I'm 4. But. We were going to see if he could sit quietly like Prahlad, but he couldn't. But anyway, still, we don't know who that person is. You know, I mean, if you saw Prabhupada as a little 3-and-a-half-year-old boy, you just think he's a little boy and just throw him out and be offhand. You know, you can't be offhand with anyone. You know, not even a child.
Yeah. He organized the Rath Yatra. He had little Radha Krishna deities.
But, you know, one thing I see that parents sometimes do is that when the children do something where they're actually manifesting some devotional sentiment, even little babies, they attribute it to something else. Even in their own children, you know, you do a kirtan, and the, you know, little 6-month-old child, they start kicking one leg, because in their mind they're dancing, but because their body doesn't quite function according to how they're thinking, just one little leg goes and one little arm, you know, they're sort of dancing, but you know, the parents would think, oh, he must be remembering that Bollywood, you know, that we showed, you know, movie we showed him this morning on the way here or something. You know, they don't attribute it to some, you know, oh, he's experiencing some spiritual impetus at that time. So, so yes, Prabhupada, you know, he would, with his sister, So that, you know, it's very easy to just write it off as imitation. Oh, they really don't know what they're doing. They're just really, you know, imitating. They've probably seen that somewhere and they're just imitating, you know, in play. But an advanced person can recognise. You know, like Prabhupada taught, you know, when he did Rath Yatra. So his father got in the Rath Yatra car. But he wasn't happy to just, you know, get a little cardboard thing that was going to fall apart, you know, 2 hours. He wanted a proper Rath Yatra car that resembled the real thing. And he wanted to distribute prasadam to everyone in the neighbourhood. You know, and kirtan, and it went for hours, and, you know, it was a big festival. Kids just don't do that, so, you know, they sort of lose interest in 5-10 minutes. Or, oh, yeah, we'll pull the card. Okay, now I'm off to play ball. There's my friends, you know. So, you know, a proper devotee would recognise, no, there's something more than just child's play here. You know, there's something special. So here, you know, Prahlad Maharaj, we see from the very beginning of his childhood, he was uninterested in childish playthings. Indeed, he gave them up altogether and remained silent and dull, being fully absorbed in Krishna consciousness. Since his mind was always affected by Krishna consciousness, he could not understand how the world goes on, being fully absorbed in the activities of sense gratification. You know, so, you know, especially when it's consistent and specifically centered around Krishna, even within children, there's something significant. You know, there's something very special about that. And similarly, you know, when people come to Krishna consciousness, you know, even very new people come to Krishna consciousness. You know, we don't just put everything they do down to imitation. You know, sometimes, you know, when you're looking at new devotees and what have you, you see that, you know, well, that's, you know, that's a very good quality, which even among devotees is quite significant that this person is doing that or has that sort of dedication or, you know, depth of thought like that. So we try and acknowledge these things. And, you know, this is one of the things you can sort of take from this discussion here, is that, you know, when we look at each other, you know, and we look at devotees in general, it is good to be able to sort of, you know, try and perceive those very significant factors which, you know, are really good qualities, something significant, you know, transcendental qualities, you know, within a devotee like that. You really have to look, though, you know, because it's not like a billboard. Like, you know, sometimes, you know, when you see devotees regularly doing a difficult service, never complaining, never making demands, never trying to get attention, never trying to get credit. You know, there's something very, you know, it's a very, you know, good quality. But unless you're looking, literally, you won't even notice that person is in the temple. So, and this is what the guru does. Actually, that's why the guru is a guru, because the guru looks. You know, the guru actually studies. You know, this person has come. You know, they actually watch everything they do. You know, it's a common trait amongst, you know, the spiritual masters in ISKCON in general that, you know, when they, my wife was telling me also that, you know, she'd met, might have been Kadambakanana Maharaj at a home program or something, and then, you know, like the next year he'd come again and he'd remember, you know, her and what she actually only saw her once, and you know what she sort of said in the discussion they had, or something. There was some, you know, she was quite taken back by that. That how, you know, that person actually noticed, you know. So, you know, that's the qualification of the guru, that they're looking, they're trained. And of course, this is what you'd expect. Someone, you know, is qualified as Bhaktivedanta. You'd expect a little bit of that. You know. What's that?
4 more years.
Four more years and the rest of eternity. Isn't it? You know, it's not like, yes, I've read the books. It's, yes, I've read the books, and when I look at devotees, I look at them differently. I try and see, you know, those nice qualities that, you know, you really have to look hard, but you see that they're very special, you know, special people. Like that. So...
one interesting experience I had. So sometimes, because we are amongst devotees, we expect certain standards, and so we try to become judgmental.
Mm.
And we try to find faults. This is my faith. But then when we go outside and interact with the other people, the totally negative state, and then you say, oh my God, there is so much of difference. Between them and the devotees.
Mm.
Then you realize, because many times you take so many things for granted actually. I had a simple experience. People do Lakshmi Puja around this time. This past Friday, it's Lakshmi Puja. And yeah, invited to people's house. So normally, traditionally, when you do Lakshmi Puja, you call the ladies. The ladies are supposed to come and sing songs to glorify Lakshmi Devi. That's how they are supposed to get together. That is, they put pashpa kumkum on each other and then they glorify Lakshmi Devi. They sing songs and then they worship Lakshmi Devi, like putting flowers and all that sort of thing. But when I was invited, now you go, there's no even talk of song. People are sitting around Lakshmi Devi and this are just pajalpa. Absolute pajalpa. And to what extent it is going, it is, oh, this person moved with this person, he left this person, and now he's going with this person. To that level, it is not just ordinary pajalpa.
I mean, special. It is maha pajalpa.
I said, this is. I also come from Indian culture, and I know what the culture is, but actually, in fact, I was not brought traditionally up because my father was in the army. Despite that, I'm saying that now, people who have been brought up traditionally, that's what they are doing. So then you start appreciating, okay, amongst the devotees, they may have faults, but definitely,
they're all...
You know, if you don't see that, we take it for granted. Take it for granted and we just see the faults. Actually, that experience brought to me that actually being in the devotee circle, I could appreciate it better. Really, that's
right.
Basically my...
That's right, because sometimes familiarity breeds contempt. And this is why every devotee should preach, because, you know, to new devotees and to young devotees, not just to new people, but to also people who have come to the movement but sort of need a little guidance, because... by, you know, associating with, you know, people from the very beginning of their spiritual lives, you can really see how far other devotees have come, you know, from that point. So, you know, when you talk to people on the street, so one of the things I'm very fortunate is, you know, probably 90% of the preaching I do is to people, literally, it's quite often the first time they come to the temple, or I'm meeting them at their home and then they're going to come to the temple. So I did a ceremony this morning, and it was a shadha. strange. The lady had the same name as my mother, and her son had the same name as me, you know, the Western names. Yeah. So she gave me a big hug because we felt there's some strange connection there. But she came here about 28 years ago when her eldest son passed away. But obviously, you know, they were, you know, this was an anniversary, 1 year for her husband had passed away. But you could see that they really, you know, beginning in many, you know, one of the things they brought for the deities was a big bag of onions, you know. You see, so. You know, I didn't say anything, but I just said, I'll leave them on my desk and, you know, I'll make sure everything goes to the bogle room, because I'll give them to my mother because she eats onions, you know. But you know, they're a long way, you know, that you can see from in a Hindu culture. A lot of Hindus would know that, you know, you probably wouldn't bring onions, garlic, you know, to the temple like that. So, you know, there's a... but you know, when you you know, you it's very nice to deal with new people like that, and then you know when you're seeing what the devotees generally there, even the new devotees, but still they're getting a little bit of accustomed to ISKCON. They're quite elevated in, you know, what their etiquettes and, you know. I mean, there's always room for improvement, but it is a fact when, you know, when you're preaching, it helps you to appreciate the devotees when you're actually preaching to people on the street or preaching to new devotees like that.
The interesting part is, Sweta and I sang that Jai Jai Radha Maha. Let's just sing it. We sang that song. And even as we were saying the beginning of that song, they were not interested. They all started talking. I said, okay, we will start a bit. Let them do their bit. Okay. Lakshmi Devi is there.
Okay. Yeah. Prahlad Maharaj was always absorbed in thought of Krishna, thus being always embraced by the Lord. He did not know how his bodily necessities, such as sitting, walking, eating, lying down, drinking and talking, were being automatically performed. Purport: a small child, while being cared for by his mother, does not know how the needs of the body for eating, sleeping, lying down, passing water and evacuating are being fulfilled. He is simply satisfied on the lap of the mother. Similarly, Prahlad Maharaj was exactly like a small child being cared for by Govinda. The necessary activities of his body were performed without his knowledge. As a father and mother care for their child, Govinda cared for Prahlad Maharaj, who remained always absorbed in thoughts of Govinda. This is Krishna consciousness. Prahlad Maharaj is a vivid example of perfection in Krishna consciousness. And here and again lies, you know, a problem of, you know, imitating a Mahabhagavat. So you see that Srila Prabhupada was on the level Prahlad Maharaj, literally, not so much, you know, in his preaching activities, he could literally just not take care of his, you know, different necessities of life. But the Mahabhagavat, in order to preach, comes down to the level of the Majjhimadhikari. In order to preach, even if one is a Mahabhagavat, they actually... they don't behave like a Mahabhagavat, they behave like a Majjhimadhikari, or, you know. Although Therefore, again, it's very hard to recognize, especially amongst preachers, Mahabhagavat. Because although they have these symptoms, in order to preach, they're showing us how to care for the body and the necessities of life properly, as if they need to do that. But they're not interested in that. You know, that doesn't even occur to them unless they have to make a conscious effort to do it for the sake of showing others. You look after your body in Krishna consciousness, look after the vehicles, look after the buildings, you know, you look after, you know, the cows, you look after the land, you look after so many things properly. Don't imitate the advanced devotees. And this is another problem that has been there in ISKCON, different places, where devotees will read this and think, ah, now I know what an advanced devotee is. Now I know what I've got to do. That. And, you know, wrongfully imitate that. you know, there are different pastimes of, you know, Srila Prabhupada that, you know, when he was trying to publish the first, you know, volume of the Bhagavatam, and just to save, you know, a few paisa, instead of taking the rickshaw, he would walk that distance in the hot sun and sometimes not having eaten properly, and then one day he literally collapsed, right? And but you know, his whole consciousness was just, I'm going to, you know, I've got some money, I've got some extra money so we can get a nicer cover for the Bhagavatam. So he's just not on, you know, not even thinking in those terms. But of course, we see that for the sake of preaching all around the world, he had to show us, you know, had to behave like a Kanishtha Adhikari, had to behave like a Majjhima Adhikari, an Uttama Adhikari, and in order to preach, even if one becomes a Mahabhagavat, they also have to, you know, behave something like a Majjhima Adhikari. So it's one of the, you know, sometimes we do see amongst some of the very elevated disciples of Srila Prabhupada, that you know, they're in that category of Mahabhagavat or Bari Mahabhagavat, very, very elevated devotees, and sometimes that shows through, but generally we don't see that side. You know, because of, you know, they're preaching, but sometimes, you know, they're a little, we get a little vision, you know, into the fact that, you know, some of those devotees literally are very carefree about, you know, their bodily necessities, how they're going to eat and, you know, do this, that or the other, eating, sleeping, you know, what have you. Any comments?
Once you think the present level you are comfortable with, then you stretch yourself. Don't stay there. Keep going up a bit. Not imitating, but also don't become complacent with where you are.
Yeah, yeah. It's definitely, one should always, you know, be trying to purify one's love for Krishna. But sometimes it appears that actually the Mahabhagavats are complacent, you know, because Sometimes upon seeing, because of advancement in Krishna consciousness, he sometimes cried, sometimes laughed, sometimes expressed jubilation, and sometimes sang loudly. So Prabhupada describes, this verse clarifies the comparison of a devotee to a child. If a mother leaves a small child in his bed or cradle and goes away to attend to some family duties, the child immediately understands that his mother has gone away and therefore he cries. But as soon as the mother returns and cares for the child laughs and becomes jubilant. Similarly, Prahlad Maharaj, being always absorbed in thoughts of Krishna, sometimes felt separation, thinking, where's Krishna? This is explained by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Sanyatam Jigatsavam Govinda Vidahanami. When an exalted devotee feels that Krishna is invisible, having gone away, he cries in separation. And sometimes when he sees that Krishna has returned to care for him, he laughs, just as a child sometimes laughs upon understanding that his mother is taking care of him. These symptoms are called bhava. In the nectar devotion, various bhavas, ecstatic conditions of a devotee, are fully described. These bhavas are visible in the activities of a perfect devotee. Sunayatam jagat saram govinda vinahinami. Text 40. Sometimes upon seeing the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Prahlad Maharaj would loudly call in full anxiety. He sometimes lost his shyness in jubilation and began dancing in ecstasy. And sometimes, being fully absorbed in thoughts of Krishna, he felt oneness and imitated the pastimes of the Lord. Purport. Prahlad Maharaj sometimes felt that the Lord was far away from him and therefore called him loudly. When he saw that the Lord was before him, he was fully jubilant. Sometimes thinking himself one with the Supreme, he imitated the Lord's pastimes. And in separation from the Lord, he would sometimes show symptoms of madness. These feelings of a devotee would not be appreciated by impersonalists. One must go further and further into spiritual understanding. The first realization is impersonal Brahman, but one must go still further to realize Paramatma and eventually the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is worshipped by the transcendental feelings of a devotee in a relationship of Santa, Dasya, Sakya, Vatsalya or Madhurya. Here the feelings of Prahlad Maharaj were in the mellow of Vatsalya, filial love and affection. As a child cries when left by his mother, when Prahlad Maharaj felt that the Lord was away from him, he began to cry. Again, a devotee like Prahlad sometimes sees that the Lord is coming from a long distance to pacify him, like a mother responding to a child saying, "My dear child, do not cry, I'm coming." Then the devotee, without being ashamed due to his surroundings and circumstances, begins to dance, thinking, "Here is my Lord is coming." Thus the devotee in full ecstasy sometimes imitates the pastimes of the Lord, just as the cowherd boys used to imitate the behaviour of the jungle animals. However, he does not actually become the Lord. Prahlad Maharaj achieved the spiritual ecstasies described herein by his advancement in spiritual understanding. Regarding verse 36, where this sort of began. That verse says, who could list innumerable transcendental qualities of Prahlad Maharaj? He had unflinching faith in Vasudeva, Lord Krishna, the son of Vasudeva, and unalloyed devotion to him. His attachment to Lord Krishna was natural because of his previous devotional service. Although his good qualities cannot be enumerated, they prove that he was a great soul, Mahatma. Now, from the nectar devotion we see this. It says, as for ecstatic love of Krishna, so we're talking about bhava, so nectar devotion, as for ecstatic love for Krishna, there is a statement in the 7th canto, 4th chapter, verse 36 of Srimad Bhagavatam, in which Narada addresses King Yudhisthira, my dear king, it is very difficult to describe the character of Prahlad. He developed a natural attraction for Krishna. Whatever I can explain about his character will simply be an arrangement of words. His actual character is impossible to describe. So he's paraphrased that in a slightly different way. This means that Narada himself admitted that the natural development of Prahlad's ecstatic love was by the grace of Lord Krishna. This natural attraction for Krishna on the part of Prahlad was developed simply by the mercy of Narada. When Prahlad Maharaj was within the womb of his mother, she was being sympathetically instructed by Narada about the science of devotional service. And at the same time, Narada was wishing that the child within the womb could also take advantage of the instructions. Because Narada, an authorized devotee and great associate of the personality of Godhead, was desiring auspiciousness for Prahlad Maharaj, he developed all the characteristics of a high-grade devotee. This is called natural attraction. It is caused by the special grace of the personality of Godhead or by the special grace of a great devotee like Narada. There is a statement in the Skanda Purana wherein Parvata Muni tells Narada, my dear Narada, of all saintly persons, you are so great and glorious that simply by your good wishes, a low-born hunter also has become a great elevated devotee of Lord Krishna. So, as we were discussing before about when a devotee is desiring someone's auspiciousness, then to please his devotee, Krishna allows people to develop in their make progress in the path of bhakti, spiritual advancement. And you know, therefore, on this basis, of course, Prabhupada said purity is the force. So it's not that if we become, introduce all sorts of, you know, whiz-bang sort of wonderful different ways of preaching, that somehow we will, you know, get a lot of people come along and they'll advance in Krishna consciousness. Actually, the principle by which people advance in Krishna consciousness is that they are taking shelter of good quality devotees. So if the devotees want to help people to become good quality devotees, they actually have to become good quality devotees, purity, perfect devotees, good quality devotees. And then their preaching will be effective. So we were discussing, you know, last week a little bit about kirtan as well. You know, if we have kirtan, and you know, it's very musically wonderful, and you know, the singers have got the beautiful voices, and they're all dressed in the beautiful clothes, and I will make so many nice devotees. No? No? Purity. When a devotee is a very dear to Krishna, because of their pure love for Krishna, then when they wish someone well and auspiciousness in their spiritual life, then Krishna allows that person to advance in Krishna consciousness. From wherever they may have left off, certainly some may have, you know, had some opportunity in their previous lives, but from where they've left off, Krishna will allow them to make further progress. And therefore we see that how this again is the mark of the greatness of Srila Prabhupada. That within the history, you know, to find someone that travels around the world to those who have no qualification, or in fact would be the most disqualified person, yet somehow or another, because Srila Prabhupada has, you know, blessed them. Yes, you've helped me spread this Krishna consciousness in some way or another, and given some blessing that those persons have in this life or the next life, able to take up Krishna consciousness by the grace of Srila Prabhupada. You know, one time Prabhupada was preaching in, might have been Matsuda's Gifts, or one of those storefront very early days, might have been the first one, and there was some bum who come in off the street. He may have been in before, he come in. He went out, and when he came back, he brought in some rolls of toilet paper because he noticed there was no toilet paper in the toilet. Mm-hmm. You know? He got a blessing. It's just a bum off the street. Somehow he's helping Prabhupada somehow or another to, you know, it all adds up to, you know, Prabhupada's there. In one sense, this is the interesting thing, that it looks as though Prabhupada is ended up penniless and without a friend or shelter in New York. And but actually that's not really the case. Prabhupada's situation like that was a great blessing of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, so that people would think, oh, poor Swamiji, you know, he has nothing, he has, you know, so, you know, let us do something for him. And then whatever they give, then Prabhupada appreciates, and because Prabhupada appreciates you've done something, then they're allowed to advance in Krishna consciousness. So, you know, sometimes it's said that the pure devotees or the spiritual master become very ill. Again, it's not ordinary. You know, one may think that, you know, oh, this is, how is it? This person is blessed by Krishna. They're supposed to be such a wonderful devotee, and yet they're becoming ill. Actually, sometimes it is the arrangement so that, you know, devotees, the disciples, can get special, intimate opportunity to do very, very valuable, confidential, intimate service to the pure devotee of the Lord. You know, there's an opportunity there. You know, it's a blessing. So nothing that happens to the, you know, exalted devotees is ordinary, appears to be ordinary, but you know, these are the arrangements of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Krishna. you know, allowing his Purita devotee to wander around the earth almost as if he is helpless like a child, and without everyone's assistance, he's really, you know, not going to be able to function. But actually, it couldn't be further from the truth.
So is it okay to say that Sumati Maharaj, because she also provided a passage to America, she's going back home back to
her? Yeah. Yeah, she did that. You know, the Bhagavad Gita...
That was the greatest service probably she did.
Yeah, she allowed Prabhupada to have that cabin on the ship, a free ticket, and make sure he had some, you know, meals coming each day.
Without her help, there would be no score.
Yeah. So therefore, you know, in the Bhagavad Gita, you know, Krishna says, where there is Krishna and Arjuna, or, you know, the representative of Arjuna, the devotee, represented the Bhagavad Gita, there will always be opulence, victory, extraordinary power, morality. So sometimes these things are not seen in the life of a very exalted devotee. And these can be arrangements so that people who can't recognize the glories of that devotee, you know, out of their, you know, perhaps piety, they render some service. And this is the beauty of the Vedic culture. The Vedic culture teaches general morality and, you know, looking after, you know, saintly people and, you know, innocent animals and women and children and, you know, brahmanas like that. So they have good manners, you know, and they're dutiful and what have you. And then sometimes they may see a person in distress and they help them out and they make sure no one goes hungry. And then when they come across a saintly person, they don't even recognize that this person may be a great devotee of Krishna or what have you. But just because of their pious background, because of the Vedic culture, what they do out of piety, they do for a devotee, and it becomes the greatest benediction, places them on the spiritual path. So, you know, that, therefore you see that the Vedic culture is a good background, that when devotees come along, they may not quite recognize the spiritual caliber of that saintly person, but their piety allows them to take advantage and to get some, render some service. Whereas without the Vedic culture, that won't happen. That may not happen. And because in Kali Yuga, you know, compassion is disappearing day by day.
Just on that point, I was reading when Prabhupada was outside Sumati Maharaj's house to see her. She, before that, when she went for Kumbh Mela, she just happened to see Prabhupada sitting under a tree and she just went and paid obeisances. There was no communication, no conversation.
Yeah.
She walked off. And when Prabhupada went to her house, Prabhupada doesn't know who she is, whom she is going to meet. But she recognized that, I've seen your
Kumbh Mela,
I paid you obeisances, come inside.
Yeah. She got the benefit of offering him obeisances to render him one of the most valuable devotional services.
That's how it began, otherwise...
That's exactly right, yeah. So just out of natural piety, not out of a sense of spiritual sentiment, they, when the saintly person is there, they are allowed to take advantage of that.
She herself was following
Bhagavacharya
Sampradaya,
so practicing whatever. So you see the value of the Vedic society. And therefore, you know, we don't condemn demigod worshippers. You know, sometimes amongst devotees, you know, they say, you know, it's almost a surprise, you know. They go to someone's house, oh, why did they even come here? They got, you know, the demigods in every cupboard, you know. Oh, gee, they're not devotees. I'm wasting my time here and going back to the temple. Actually, it's a very conducive background, you know. At least, you know, better than demigods and Hitler and, you know, Michael Jackson or, you know, something. You know, it's a real, you know, if someone has some faith in the demigods, they've got a real foothold, an opportunity. There's something you can tap into their general piety that they can take advantage of the presence of a devotee better than those who are not demigod worshippers sometimes, you know. You know, it can be an advantage for them. We shouldn't take them as, you know, they're Hindus, you know. We're wasting our time there.
Well, then if we don't give prasadam there, then are we, and we offend them, then?
Yeah. Well, you know, it takes a little bit of practice to sort of see, you know, what they may want to do, and you know, and you understand. Oh, you know, I don't want to partake of that. I want to sort of engage them, but in a way that you know is not against. You know, my sort of standards or what have you, then, you know, you just got to be a little bit careful and, you know, you sort of know what to expect from what they sometimes want to do. You know, as I was saying, you know, like this morning, the people who come to do the ceremony, they offered, you know, a bag of onions. To, you know, they wanted to give that to Krishna. So I didn't get them to take it into the temple. I just said, yeah, put it on my desk in the room. I'll take care of it, of which I'll give it to my mother. So, but I didn't even mention that, you know, because you can't tell people everything in the, you know, in their first occasion. You know, I mean, if people are having a wonderful day. And then within that, you say one thing about something they did wrong. That's the thing they'll remember. Mm-hmm. Right? They can do 1,000 things right, and they haven't. It's wonderful. And then you say, "You can't offer onions." And that would be the thing that they'll remember. 20 years, they'll come back. I remember you. You were the one who told me. I felt so embarrassed. I didn't come back for 15 years. yeah. Yeah, I mean, Prabhupada preached all over the world. So there's obviously a way to do it. Prabhupada, when he was in, you know, the Agarwals, right? Because they, you know, he had to keep his food in that fridge as well. But he saw there was also meat there because I think they had some pets. So they used to eat meat, yeah, yeah. So, you know, he had to, you know, without offending them, sort of just, you know, be very, very liberal.
The general statement is, for preaching purpose, it's okay. But sometimes, even when you're going socializing, that is also preaching. That's the whole point. See, the general statement I hear is, okay, for preaching, you are going to somebody's house and sometimes you have to, okay, you see the circumstances, but then in the social circle, it's not required. But then people see, oh, these are Krishna devotees, this is how they behave. And so, I mean, that's also in a way how you behave is forming a part of the teaching.
Well, you know, see, so this is an interesting point. So here, you're distinguishing socializing with preaching. Now, we're hearing how Prahlad, he wouldn't even understand what that meant, socializing. What do you mean? You know, what's to say here? It's like, it says, In verse 37 it says, since his mind was always affected by Krishna consciousness, he could not understand how the world goes on being fully absorbed in the activities of sense gratification. So because wherever he went, he would just see, here's an opportunity to serve Krishna, you'd have to explain to him what socializing is, in one sense. He sort of just wouldn't have a concept that, oh, this is something different from Krishna. There is no different from Krishna consciousness, see? So for a preacher, they never ever think, oh, this is socializing, this is preaching. They only think this is another preaching, you know, wherever they are, this is another preaching. You know, they're thinking socializing, but I'm thinking preaching, you see? So, so therefore there's not a problem. So if we think, oh, we have to behave in a certain way for socializing, a certain way for preaching, there's a problem. But if we, you know, we're not socializing, we're, you know, everything is just preaching, then there's not a problem. And this is the way Prahlad Maharaj is seeing things. And you know, that's so, and you can see how Prabhupada brought people to very elevated platform of devotional service by making them preach. That they literally get some of these qualities you see in Prahlad Maharaj. Because they're just thinking, they're Prabhupada conscious, they're preaching consciousness, and that's all they perceive, you know, like, so they're coming to that, when they read about Prahlad, they think, yeah, I can relate to that, you know. And that's the potency of preaching, you know. Krishna says in the Gita that there's no one more dear to me than one who preaches Krishna consciousness. What does that mean? Just as we read here in the Nectar Devotion, that this is called natural attraction. It is caused by the special grace of the personality of Godhead or by the special grace of great devotee like Narada. So when you preach, you please Prabhupada so much, and that pleases Krishna so much, that by the special grace, you know, the history of ISKCON is that people coming along with no qualification, don't know anything about spiritual life or Vedic culture, and they're actually developing qualities that you might expect to see in Prahlad Maharaj. You see? And that's what's called the special grace of Krishna and his devotee. That's the beauty of preaching, is that, you know, when you read the Bhagavatam, of course, we get an intellectual understanding. But if you preach Krishna consciousness, which especially not in the mood that I'm preaching, I'm a big preacher. Not in that mood. I'm preaching, if there's some tiny little insignificant service I can do to Srila Prabhupada, in that mood, you get unlimited mercy. Because if your consciousness is, I'm trying to serve Prabhupada, and this is actually, here we're talking about, you know, previously senior devotees. Right? That, you know, you can neglect senior devotees, you can recognize them. This is the principle why you try to go out of your way to find senior devotees and acknowledge them. Because if you, find devotees that are dear to Krishna, they spend a lifetime preaching, sacrificing everything. And you do a little service for them because they're such a nice devotee and so dear to Krishna. Krishna will immediately recognize you. Even that service is insignificant, but because that devotee is so dear to Krishna, Krishna will recognize. We have a different system springing up in ISKCON. Let me be recognized for my great ability. I'm the great preacher. I'm doing this. I'm doing so many things. I have so many projects like this, that and the other. That's nonsense. A devotee's mood is, here are the nice devotees of Krishna. They're so dear to Krishna. I have no, you know, qualifications on the spiritual path. I'm a great offender of Krishna. But if I can somehow find a little corner of the heart of these nice devotees, Krishna will take notice of me. And therefore, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati the Kaur said, don't act in such a way that you will see Krishna, but act in such a way that Krishna will see you. And the secret to doing that is to be the humble servant. Any little service to the in the line of Srila Prabhupada, no matter how insignificant that may appear, it takes on monumental significance, because Krishna will notice the smallest thing that you do for Srila Prabhupada, as opposed to all the big grandest things we do, which are sort of done in the name that, you know, I'm the big preacher. And, you know, if you look at Srila Prabhupada's, you know, what he did was glorious beyond what you could speak of. And yet, if he ever spoke of it, he would say, you know, or, you know, people say that I've done this wondrous thing. I do not know any wondrous thing. You know, all I know is that, you know, I have tried to serve, you know, my spiritual master, and, you know, what he has given, you know, I've not tried to change anything, just like that. So Prabhupada took the legacy of the Acharyas, not considering himself, oh, I'm a big preacher, where do they see me? Here's his wonderful contribution by his spiritual master, by the Acharyas. If I can just carry that and present that for the world to see, here is what my spiritual master has given, and the Acharyas and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. That was all he like the mailman, you know. But that quality of devotee is very rare to be found. The devotee who remains the humble servant of the spiritual master, of the Vaishnava, and therefore there's that prayer by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, you know, I am not a sannyasi, I am not a grihasta, I'm not a vanaprastha, chatriya brahmana, this, that, or the other. Or none of these things. I am the servant of the servant of the servant of the lotus feet of Krishna, the maintainer of the gopis. Servant of the servant of the servant. That move. And when one takes that mood, one may think, oh, you know, if I have this humble mood, how will I ever make progress in this movement? You know, who will ever notice me? You know, how will I get the blessings? Well, one person will notice, and that is Krishna. And by Krishna's arrangement, everything will be done. So, but yeah, the interesting thing here is that you see how some of these qualities in Prahlad Maharaj you see in just people who took the Krishna consciousness, have taken the Krishna consciousness and just preached to please Prabhupada, not thinking themselves a devotee at all, but just, you know, they just love Prabhupada and let me just do something for Prabhupada, and they start developing these wonderful qualities. Of course, if they, you know, continue to do that, sometimes pride comes in after some time, and then instead of being the humble servant, they're now a big devotee, and that's where the problems start to begin. So, text 41. Sometimes feeling the touch of the Lord's lotus hands, he became spiritually jubilant and remained silent, his hairs standing on end and tears gliding down from his half-closed eyes because of his love for the Lord. Report: when a devotee feels separation from the Lord, he becomes eager to see where the Lord is. And sometimes when he feels pangs of separation, tears flow incessantly from his half-closed eyes. As stated by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in his Shishashika, Yugaitam Namishina Chakshusha Prabhushaitam. The words Chakshusha Prabhushaitam refer to tears falling incessantly from the devotee's eyes. These symptoms which appear in pure devotional ecstasy were visible in the body of Prahlad Maharaj.
Prabhu, which form of the Lord Prahlad meditating?
Well, as we discussed last week, you know, his attachment is to Krishna. And that's why he's not afraid of Nrisimha, because, you know, he understands he's Krishna. So, like in verse 36, which we quoted that from Nectar Devotion, again, you know, it's in that there, Prabhupada says, that means that Narada himself admitted that the natural development of Prahlad's ecstatic love was by the grace of Lord Krishna. This natural attraction for Krishna on the part of Prahlad was developed simply by the mercy of Narada. So, Prabhupada's always using the word Krishna. You know, constantly using the word Krishna as far as Prahlad's love is for Krishna. But he knows that Nrisimha is Krishna.
Yeah.
Did the Nrisimha that appeared before? Because there was mentioned somewhere that this form has never appeared before, and that even the other stems are and
Lakshmi
are
you know, he recognizes Krishna. You know, the same in the prayers of Lalita, I think it's in the Hamsa Duda, you know, and she's describing that. She's sending a prayer, a letter to Krishna, you know, in the form of, you know, Varaha, etc. You know, lifted the earth which had sunk into the depths of oblivion. You know, so you please lift our hearts which are sunk in the depths of separation and sorrow. So she went through, you know, the different avatars and, you know, Krishna, you know, in your form as Nrisimha. Krishna in your form as, you know. So, the devotees, they're just seeing that this is Krishna, you know. So even though they're seeing Nrisimha, you know, they just still understand, you know, that's Krishna. That's it.
Even in the prayers,
he is Krishna, Mother of Krishna. Yeah, and Jagadish, Keshava, yeah, means Krishna. Jagadish means Krishna. By Keshava Jita, you know, Jai Jagadisha. In other words, we understand that in those Das Avatar, we're only referring to one person, Keshava. He's only praying to one person, Keshava. It appears that he's praying to 10 different gods. But because he only uses the term Keshava, then we say, oh, he's only praying to one person, Keshava. Who is that Keshava? Oh, he's the same person that appears as Buddha and Nrisimha, this, that and the other. See? That's the importance of the Dasavatar Stotra, that it points to Krishna only. It appears to be a prayer to the... but it's a prayer to Krishna. So, Yeah.
But in Bhagavatam, even in, there's prayers given to Lord Brahma, we say that the demigod, the Asatri is the Supreme Lord. Then we have seen when there are prayers to Lord Shiva, they pray that way, as if he's a Supreme Lord.
Mm-hmm.
And then Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, and they don't say anything.
Well, sometimes they do.
They don't say that, no, I'm not the Supreme Lord. No.
Well, as we said, because, you know, that background of piety will ultimately be helpful to it, because they are representing the Supreme, but sometimes it's too much information to give someone straight away. But so it's not as if they're under false pretenses, because they are representing the Supreme, and therefore, in that sense, they're as good as the Supreme. When personalities serve Lord Brahma or Shiva, Krishna says in the Gita, although they're worshipping them, actually they're worshipping me. So that means they're worshipping the Supreme. So Krishna says that. When they're worshipping Brahma, they're worshipping Shiva, they're worshipping Indra, it says, but actually they're worshipping me. So therefore it's not wrong to say that they're worshipping the Supreme. It's just that they don't know it. They're doing it indirectly, but it's a step towards the direct worship of the Supreme. And, you know, these symptoms here of you know, hair standing on the end, tears gliding down, and that we can't imitate those. And yet at the same time, by the association of very advanced devotees, it is described that one, you know, even a neophyte can experience symptoms of bhava. They can sincerely cry for Krishna and be ecstatic, hair standing on end. They can, you know, the difference is it's not necessarily permanent. You know, when it's permanently fixed, then we say that person's on the platform of bhava. That means it's permanently on that. But they can get a glimpse of it, they get a taste of it in the association of very advanced devotees. Bhava. 42. Because of his association with perfect unalloyed devotees who had nothing to do with anything material, Prahlad Maharaj constantly engaged in the service of the Lord's lotus feet. By seeing his bodily features when he was in perfect ecstasy, persons very poor in spiritual understanding became purified. In other words, Prahlad Maharaj bestowed upon them transcendental bliss. Report: apparently, Prahlad Maharaj was placed in circumstances in which he was always tortured by his father. In such material conditions, one cannot have an undisturbed mind. But since bhakti is unconditional, Prahlad Maharaj was never disturbed by the chastisements of Hiranyakashipu. On the contrary, the bodily symptoms of his ecstatic love for the Supreme Personality of Godhead turned the minds of his friends, who had also been born in atheistic families. Instead of being disturbed by the torments of his father, Prahlad influenced his friends and cleansed their minds. A devotee is never contaminated by material conditions. A person subjected to material conditions can become spiritually advanced and blissful upon seeing the behaviour of a pure devotee. So again, you know, that is, you know, the platform of a preacher. They're never contaminated, you know, they're mature enough in their spiritual life that they're not contaminated by material conditions. But the persons they're associating with, who are subject to material conditions, they become spiritually advanced and blissful upon seeing the behaviour of pure devotee. That's That's what one requires to come to that level of spiritual advancement in order to preach. My dear King Yudhisthira, the demon Hiranyakashipu tormented this exalted, fortunate devotee, although Prahlad was his own son. Purport: when a demon like Hiranyakashipu, despite his elevated position, due to severe austerities, began to tease the devotee, he begins falling down, and the result of his austerities dwindle. One who oppresses a pure devotee loses all the results of his austerities, penances, and pious activities. Since Hiranyakashipu is now inclined to chastise his most exalted devotee son, Prahlad Maharaj, his opulence has begun dwindling. So you see the danger. Anyone asks, you know, is it really that dangerous to commit Vaishnava aparadha? Only if you don't mind losing the results of all your austerities, penances, and pious activities. Maharaj Yudhisthira said, "O best of the saints among the demigods, O best of spiritual leaders, how did Hiranyakashipu give so much trouble to Prahlad Maharaj, the pure and exalted saint? Although Prahlad was his own son, I wish to know about this subject from you." Purport: to know about the Supreme Personality of Godhead and the characteristics of his pure devotee, one must inquire from authorities like Devi Rishi Narada. One cannot inquire about a transcendental subject matters from a layman. As stated in the Srimad Bhagavatam 325.25. Only by association with devotees can one authoritatively understand the position of the Lord and his devotees. One cannot understand anything spiritual from a materialistic scholar puffed up with academic knowledge. As stated in Bhagavad Gita 18.55, one must try to understand Krishna by devotional service and from a devotee. Therefore, Yudhisthira Maharaj was quite right in wanting to learn further about Prahlad Maharaj from Sri Narada Muni. A father and mother are always affectionate to their children. When the children are disobedient, the parents chastise them, not due to enmity, but only for the child's instruction and welfare. How did Hiranyakashipu, the father of Prahlad Maharaj, chastise such a noble son? This is what I am eager to know. Maharaj Yudhisthira further inquired, how is it possible for a father to be so violent toward an exalted son who is obedient, well-behaved and respectful to his father? O Brahmana, O Master, I have never heard of such a contradiction as an affectionate father's punishing his noble son with the intention of killing him. Kindly dissipate our doubts in this regard.
This also shows the non-devotees have not good qualities, because as soon as they feel threatened...
That's right.
They just told he was obedient, but he was not.
What's that? Well, he thought he was being obedient.
He was obedient to the saints, that when father asked him to drink water, he drank. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, we're gonna hear about that. Yeah. In what sense do you think he because he was preaching? Yeah, we're going to hear about that. What was going on within the heart of Prahlad Maharaj, that he was preaching Krishna consciousness, and we'll see, you know, the innocent nature of that. that's chapter 5.
It's really innocent because at the same time he would fold his hands and pay obeisances to his father and he'd be very respectful.
Yeah.
And at the same time he would say, oh my dear father, oh best of the demons.
Yeah. Yeah, but his father liked it.
That's glorification.
That's his father appreciated that. they were openly against the demigods. And he was the best among them.
Father knew that he was a demon, he was the best of the demons.
He was the best amongst his kind. We'll leave it there, and we'll have a look at, follow on.
I'm just saying, it was the word of wisdom.
So that comes up in the next chapter, and we'll look into that a little bit more. All right, thank you very much, Hare Krishna. We'll see you next Saturday. Yeah, so nothing on next Saturday, but we. Yeah, that's good. No festivals.